We go now to hear excerpts from a presentation by Richard Falk, with an introduction by Rashid Khalidi, titled The Palestinian Future After Gaza. Richard Falk was presenting at the Edward W. Said Memorial Lecture, co-sponsored by Columbia's Heyman Center for the Humanities. It's given once a year in honor of the public intellectual and literary critic Edward W. Said, who taught in the English and Comparative Literature Department at Columbia from 1963 to 2003. Richard Falk is a professor of international law and practice at Princeton University. We go now to hear excerpts from his presentation.
You can only imagine how, starting in 2008, the year in which Operation Cast Lead began, the attack on Gaza from the December of 2008 through January of 2009, and continuing for 6 years through a little more than a year ago, what kind of circumstances Richard Falk found himself in. He was obliged by his training, by his humanity, by his knowledge of the law to call a spade a spade. And he did so with forthrightness, with honesty, and received a deluge of vituperation that no human being should have to endure. And I want you to think of this as you listen to him this evening. This is the voice not only of learning and knowledge of the law, and of various other things. I'm going to read a few of the titles so you see precisely what I'm talking about. But someone who has spent 6 years trying to apply these principles in the most difficult of circumstances. In the past 50 years, a little under 50 years, Richard Falk has written and edited over 25 books. That's a book every 2 years. But four of them are multi-volume works. Four volumes, five volumes. In fact, if you count it in volumes, it's a book every year and a bit. These include, and I'm just going to read some of the titles, The Role of Domestic Courts in the International Legal Order, The Strategy of World Order, Legal Order in a Violent World. Think of these titles when you think of what he was doing as a UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine. The Status of Law in International Society, The Vietnam War and International Law. That was a four-volume work. The kind of knowledge and learning, which most of the time is cooped up in the academy, and actually applied it to the real world. He has found that his training, his background, his knowledge are things that actually are needed in the world. And he's gone out in spite of extraordinary pressure on him not to do so, and, as I said before, called a spade a spade. This is a man who is a very distinguished successor to some very distinguished speakers in this series. So I ask you to join me in welcoming Richard Falk.
I should be quite angry at Rashid for introducing me in a way that I'm sure I can't live up to, but I'll forgive him. So to appreciate Edward's rejection of Oslo as a framework for peace, it is necessary to consider what was wrong about it from a Palestinian viewpoint. I would point to five features. First of all, the fragmentation of the West Bank into areas A, B, and C, making untenable territorial coherence during the period of occupation. Secondly, the idea that Palestinian goals may be achieved on the basis of Israeli consent, despite already in 1967 the United Nations Security Council unanimously mandated a withdrawal from the territory occupied during the 1967 war. Thirdly, the designation of the United States as the permanent intermediary for these negotiations, despite its partisan alignment with Israel, which already was in the driver's seat from a diplomatic perspective. And fourth, and maybe most important of all, the exclusion of international law and the authority of the United Nations from the negotiating process, which was the Palestinian trump in their political deck of cards. International law was clearly on the side of Palestinians in relation to their main claims and grievances. This included borders, refugees, settlements, Jerusalem, and water, as well as the day-to-day practices associated with the occupation itself. Without the inclusion of Palestinian rights under international law, diplomacy degenerates into a bargaining process, which ensures that power disparities will be embodied in any negotiated solution, and a heavily slanted, one-sided outcome in Israel's favor would be falsely proclaimed as peace. Even Palestinian objections to continuing Israeli settlement expansion as unlawful were rebuffed by Washington as unhelpful obstructions to the supposed peace process. The Palestinian humiliation was most vividly expressed by their acceptance of the 1993 Declaration of Principles that did not even refer to the Palestinian inalienable right of self-determination. Fifth and finally, the perverse deepening of such an exclusion by acquiescing in Israel's unlawful activities as being validated outside the negotiating framework. For instance, by George W. Bush's letter to Ariel Sharon in April 2004 to the effect that the U.S. government agrees that any end of the conflict must include the incorporation of the settlement blocks into Israel's territory. Hillary Clinton, while Obama's Secretary of State, added to this hegemonic sanitation of illegality, calling the settlement phenomenon, quote-unquote, subsequent developments that must be acknowledged by the Palestinians if they genuinely sought peace. The unreasonableness of the deconstructed Oslo approach as a means to achieve a just peace is accentuated, in my view, by the prior unheralded forthcomingness of the PLO in its earlier endorsement of the 1988 Palestinian National Council decision to recognize Israel within its 67 borders. Such a bold unilateral initiative, supported by Edward when announced, in effect gave up the PLO's earlier refusal to accept the existence of Israel in any form, and it exhibited a willingness to swallow a territorial arrangement that accorded the Palestinians only 22% of historic Palestine. As is well known, this was less than half of what the UN in the partition plan of 1947 had offered, which at the time seemed grossly unfair given the relative size of the Jewish and Palestinian populations. The fact that such a unilateral diplomatic initiative by the Palestinians failed to yield any acknowledgement at all from Israel, much less some sort of reciprocal gesture, raises deep doubts as to whether, even then, when a far more moderate leadership existed in Tel Aviv, was there any real Israeli interest in achieving a two-state solution? This seems accurate despite the verbal assurances to the contrary over the years, including by Netanyahu, while at the same time taking a variety of steps that make the possibility of a Palestinian viable sovereign state less and less attractive to the Palestinians. These elements of the overall situation are descriptive of the defeatist period of the Palestinian intergovernmental posture that seemed ready to settle for arrangements that disregarded Palestinian rights under international law. There was considerable anxiety among Palestinian intellectuals around the Clinton initiative in 2000 that Arafat might make a deal that accepted the settlements and relinquished the rights of several million Palestinian refugees. In fact, the Second Intifada was interpreted at the time as a warning, as much a warning to the PLO as it was a rebuff of Israel. There were further disquieting developments in this period: massive settlement expansion, a refusal by Israel to respect the 2004 World Court findings calling for the dismantling of the separation wall, an apartheid structure of occupation in the West Bank, a process of incremental ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem, and a harsh regime of collective punishment imposed on Gaza that featured three Israeli campaigns of state terror against a caged population in the course of the last 6 years. These attacks on Gaza, of warlike ferocity, that were unprecedented in locking the civilian population into the combat zone, disallowing even women and children to claim refugee status by crossing the border or seeking secure sanctuary within Gaza. Yet these dispiriting realities are far from the whole story of Palestinian resistance and struggle. The formal leadership of Palestine may have taken the defeatist route, but Palestinians as a people, by and large, kept their faith in the necessity of resistance and of not giving up their long quest for a sustainable and just peace. We need to remember that Edwards rejected the defeatist interpretation of the Palestinian lost cause, and in the process transferred his energies from the bankruptcy of top-down diplomacy to the empowering potential of bottom-up, people-oriented civil society militancy. This shift can be situated most dramatically in 1987, the time of the First Intifada, a mobilization of Palestinian resistance that was nonviolent yet withheld all cooperation from the occupier. It was reinforced by the Second Intifada in 2000 that was again in part a populist reaction to Israeli policies but lacked the nonviolent discipline of the earlier uprising. In 2005, a joint appeal from 170 Palestinian civil society organizations to launch a global boycott and divestment and sanctions campaign with its own defined political goals was a step toward resituating the national Palestinian movement. It represented a further shift in the direction of civil society leadership and toward a movement of global solidarity that has been gaining momentum in the last couple of years. This momentum was further accelerated by the moral outrage generated by the Israeli 50-day attack on Gaza that commenced in July of this year. This reaction seemed especially strong in Western Europe. What seemed a defining moment in 1993 has now been superseded by a recent cluster of events, a new defining moment in 2014, which involves a reformulation of perceptions in relation to the Palestinian struggle. In some ways, the situation from the Palestinian perspective has never seemed darker, undoubtedly making the cynical realist write off the conflict in even more strident language. The direct talks between Israel and the Palestinians have collapsed, and the lack of commitment by the Netanyahu government has been made explicit. The Israeli Knesset recently elected Reuven Rivlin as the 10th president of Israel, and he is, for the first time in such a high position, an outspoken advocate of incorporating the whole of the West Bank into Israel, along with Jerusalem, and implementing an Israeli one-state solution, that fulfills the maximalist version of the Zionist project. Rivlin, unlike Netanyahu, believes that the oppression of the Palestinians should be eased, provided that they agree to live in law-abiding peace within a Jewish state that would once and for all extinguish Palestinian political dreams. Distressingly, also, the Arab countries in this recent conflict actually sided with Israel because of their own priorities directed at defeating grassroots Islamically oriented political movements in the region. And then Israeli public opinion, according to the Israeli peace activist and political figure Yuri Avneri, was 99% behind the fury of the attacks. Others noted high-level and populist incitement to genocide during the conduct of Operation Protective Edge. Once more, Gaza was devastated by attacks that killed more than 2,100 Palestinians, injured another 11,000, and traumatized the entire population, which was, as I suggested, locked into the combat zone with no means of escape. And the U.S. Congress remains as unconditionally committed to Israel as ever. To express its defiance of public opinion, Israel announced very dramatic settlement expansions that included the seizure of 1,000 acres of strategically located land between southern Jerusalem and Bethlehem, bisecting any prospective, possible Palestinian state, and added 26 housing units to its approved list of what settlements could do to expand. This pattern of developments reveals an Israel facing little diplomatic pressure to resolve the conflict by negotiations and no incentive on its own to do so. For Palestine, there exists only a fragile unity between the PLO and Hamas and a debilitating dependence on Israel and the United States for the funds needed to maintain order in the territories under their administrative control. Yet in the face of this, one of the most brilliant Palestinian analysts of the conflict, Ali Abu Nima, writes these startling sentences at the very beginning of his fine new book, The Struggle for Justice in Palestine, and I quote, "The Palestinians are winning. This might seem like hubris or even insensitivity. After all, in so many ways, things have never looked worse." We must ask, what does Abu Nima mean by winning, and what basis can he have for being hopeful while being keenly aware of the dire situation facing the Palestinians? Abu Nima is, in effect, telling my French diplomat to look deeper at the overall picture if he wants to understand the true reality of the situation. It is not a matter of how long you look that matters, but what you see. And what should we see? There are a few factors to consider: the discrediting of Oslo, the growth of the global solidarity movement, the moves toward Palestinian political unity, the recognition of Israeli criminality and American complicity as increasing pressures on the Palestinian Authority to take their complaints to the International Criminal Court, and growing evidence that Israel is more worried about what it calls the delegitimation project than about the threats posed by Palestinian armed resistance. And finally, the upsurge of regional extremism in the Middle East that could at some point undermine Israel's security. What Abu Nima sees that the realist, unblinkered vision misses are the legitimacy and psychopolitical dimensions of conflict that are so crucial in our post-colonial world. These dimensions center on the powerful mobilizing impact on a population of a denial of its inalienable right of self-determination and other elemental rights. This is particularly so, as in the Palestinian case, if the denial rests on colonialist patterns of occupation that are partially sustained by links to geopolitical actors, in this instance, the United States. Let me end with a reaffirmation of the complex relationship between our limited knowledge, especially of the future, and our political and moral will that has the irreducible freedom to create its own horizons. It is for this reason alone that it seems empowering to join with Edward Said and Zizek in declaring that our defense of lost causes, in this instance that of the Palestinian people, who have endured an unspeakable ordeal of victimization for so long, as in South Africa, where in the end the racist white elites were able to remain after the collapse of the apartheid regime, it will take a comparable political miracle to reach a just and sustainable peace in Palestine that upholds the equal dignity of both peoples. In this spirit, I end with the enigmatic plea of the poet W.H. Auden. We who are about to die demand a miracle. Thank you very much.
That was Richard Falk speaking at the Edward Said Memorial Lecture.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.